what you wanted us to be. We are what we are. That's the way it's going to be. If you don't know, you can't educate us or no equal opportunity.
That's Bob Marley and the Wailers with Babylon System. It's from his classic 1979 album, Survival. This is Lead Stories. I'm your Trace Lead. It is Tuesday, February the 10th, and our guest, Professor Charles L. Lumpkins, returns to complete his presentation on black labor from the Civil War to the turn of the 21st century. Dr. Lumpkins is a lecturer of labor and employment relations at Pennsylvania State University, where he earned his doctorate degree, in history. And he started this presentation last Thursday, talking about the African-American labor from the Civil War to the turn of the 21st century, covering the periods of chattel slavery, Reconstruction, and today the Gilded Age and the Progressive Era. You may want to check the archives at leadstories.podbean.com for part one, which aired on the 5th. Dr. Lumpkins, as I said, is a lecturer of labor and employment relations at Pennsylvania State University and teaches history and African American studies. He also holds a master's degree in library science. His scholastic research focuses particularly on the history of social and political movements and the history of the working class. Dr. Lumpkins is the author of the highly praised American Pogrom, The East St. Louis Race Riot and Black Politics. It is a necessary historical reference for the state of affairs that we have been covering in Ferguson, Missouri. And I welcome you, Dr. Lumpkins, once again to Lead Stories.
How do you do, Utrecht? How are
things? Thanks. I'm so delighted that you could join us again today. And you will take us through the other part of your presentation. Tell us where you're going to take us today.
Okay. Well, I'm more than happy to pick up where I left off, namely at the end of Reconstruction and heading forward. Now, I know that there were some questions that brought me back into slavery. If you want me to drop back to then, that's fine. But otherwise, I'm ready to move forward from Reconstruction.
Well, let's go.
Okay. Very good. Yes. As I was saying about Reconstruction, of course, with the ex-slaves, most of them remained on the land, remained on the plantations and farms, because that's where Northern policymakers, Northern investment investors, capitalists, and plus those folks who were interested in industrializing the South wanted the black folks to stay on the land, continue working, cultivating cotton, which was more like the 19th century equivalent of petroleum as far as the United States was concerned. It was a real wealth maker. So in African Americans who were who had the expertise in cotton cultivation continue that way. Now, not all of them cultivated cotton. Some of them went on to engage in other activities, collecting turpentine or working at sawmills, engaging in small industrial work. But what evolved as far as African-American labor was concerned in the South was that the preference was to keep them on the land and to reserve industrial work for white Southerners who were losing their land or ownership of land or at least losing the means to make a decent livelihood on the land as the rest of the 19th century unfolded. So with that in mind, we have a core group of African Americans, a majority of African Americans, doing mainly in work in rural regions of the South. In the cities, North and South, there was a large group, a significant population of artisans. Let's say that you can call them self-employed crafts workers. Or self-employed professionals. Now, they will start to lose ground, both North and South, as immigration from Europe increased, as a number of labor unions basically denied African-Americans entrance into certain occupations, and employers also denied certain occupations to African-Americans. So we have that development going on, which when Booker T. Washington began to make his presence felt after 1896, between 1896 and 1915, the year of his death, Booker T. Washington put his bets on African Americans building or artisan and craft worker positions, vocational, what we might call vocational positions in the economy, mindful that industrialization was closing doors to Americans of all colors who want to continue to be artisans and craft workers. And again, the same was going on in the North. But in some cities in the North, for example, St. Louis, St. Louis, Missouri, East St. Louis, Illinois, and other border cities that straddle the line between Northern industrial culture and Southern, let's say the Southern political economy, whatever that, however you want to define that, other border cities like Evansville, Indiana, Louisville, Kentucky, Cincinnati, Ohio, even up to Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania. We do see increasing numbers of African Americans, perhaps 10%, 20%, 30%, entering into industrial occupations. I'm talking about the men now, in both North and South. I'll get to the women in just a moment, but with African American men in those border cities, some will go into steel production, iron foundry work, meat packing, glass working, so on and so forth. So we see a development of what Joe Trotter, a historian, the African American experience would call the proletarianization, excuse me, what a mouthful, of African American labor. In cities, North and South, we do see African Americans engage in service work. For example, barbershops, cutting hair of white men as well as black men. but that will change dramatically by the turn of the 20th century in those type of service occupations. But during this time period, let's say from 1868, when African Americans got the right to be citizens, 1870, when African American men got the right to vote, and two, let's say, it varied in different states, but let's say 1896 with the Plessy versus Ferguson court case that the federal government said segregation, separate but equal, is constitutional. So between that period, African Americans, even though they were citizens, their citizenship was being challenged. And that's a major factor that will bedevil African Americans until the modern civil rights movement. Modern civil rights movement, I usually peg around in the 1950s, beginning in the 1950s. Although some people say, and I agree with them, that the civil rights movement has its roots back in the 19th century. Some say the 1860s, some will go to the 1890s. I'm not going to debate the beginnings. I just agree that the roots of the civil rights movement is definitely, the roots are definitely in the 19th century, late 19th century. Okay. Let's see now. There are other things. Excuse me for sketching things out, but I must lay out the background because there are many facets going on simultaneously, and they will begin to coalesce in the early part of the 20th century. African Americans generally were not adverse to, labor unions. In fact, some were for labor unions. The problem was that some labor unions were not open to African Americans. They excluded them. Some that did not exclude African Americans had them in segregated auxiliaries or segregated union locals. But some unions were open to African Americans. I'm thinking like the Teamsters in the United Mine Workers of America. Now, that's not perfect. Was not perfect. There were union locals, especially in the North, and some that excluded African Americans, and those two unions that ordinarily welcome African Americans. And in the South, when Jim Crow or American apartheid became legalized, became the law of the land, segregated unions. Okay, when we think of labor unions, of course, we're thinking of, at this point in time, 1880s on into the 20th century, the American Federation of Labor, which was basically a federation of labor unions that were predominantly interested in organizing skilled workers, craft workers, wage workers in the crafts and skills. The American Federation of Labor had little interest in organizing unskilled workers. And, of course, many of these unskilled workers were European immigrants. Many were women workers. Many women workers were unskilled workers. And many African-American wage workers were unskilled workers. So they and the American Federation of Labor basically left them out on the cold. At the same time, there were alternative labor unions or labor federations. For example, the Knights of Labor. The Knights of Labor, which began in the late 1860s and really started to increase their membership during the course of the 1870s into the 1880s before the Haymarket Affair or the Haymarket Riot in Chicago basically spelled the end of the Knights of Labor. The Knights of Labor welcomed African Americans workers. It also welcomed women workers of all colors as well. The only, as far as race or racism was concerned, the Knights of Labor was essentially, it excluded the Chinese immigrants, Chinese Americans, and that were, who were concentrated on the West Coast, California in particular. So that was an unfortunate situation as far as the House of Labor was concerned at that time, that the Chinese were excluded because they were an important part of the workforce in California. But, interestingly, the Knights of Labor welcomed African Americans, more so because by 1870, African Americans were citizens. And unions could make more headway when their members were citizens than not citizens. And the Knights of Labor had an outlook of building a cooperative society, building cooperatives. the Knights of Labor were like a good segment of the American population were weary of what wage labor meant to them. Some of them thought wage labor was another form of slavery, wage slavery. Working for wages was a way was to be enslaved to the employer. It was a way pay workers low wages, keep them in debt. No different than what happened to slaves, no different than what happened to many coal miners in company towns and the hollows and patches of West Virginia, Pennsylvania, Ohio, Kentucky, where they would be in debt, debt to the company store. As that song that Paul Robeson made famous, others made famous, I owe my soul to the company store. But, yeah, the whole idea of debt, keep people in debt, that's been a that bedeviled working people at that time and still haunt working people today. Okay, but African Americans did make progress in certain occupations like coal mining, Teamsters, more so where they are well represented, like maybe 30-40% or more of the workforce in that particular occupation in a given area. For example, the coal fields of southern West Virginia or the coal fields around Birmingham. They made inroads into the steel mills of Birmingham, Alabama. They were very pronounced in terms of numbers and influence of the docks of this, of the waterfront in New Orleans, of St. Louis, Missouri. So there are these spots here or there that African Americans participated in and were involved in unions. And in my own study of East St. Louis, African Americans did join unions where they could, or they created unions where they could. The stereotype of African Americans being strike breakers, yes, they were brought in as strike breakers and some strikes, especially very dramatic strikes, like the strike of the railroad or the railway union back in 1894, and there was a big strike in Chicago, I believe, in 1904 and 1905, where that reputation of African Americans as strike breakers were just the African Americans couldn't shake off that reputation. Other ethnic groups participated in strike breaking at the same time. Other ethnic groups were able to move ahead on the economic ladder because a good portion of them did engage in strike breaking. And there were moments when white workers broke strikes that African Americans initiated. Again, like in my study of East St. Louis, I came across reference in newspapers about white workers breaking a strike of black workers at a particular firm company in East St. Louis. But I tend to believe, of course, I haven't run across anyone who did the number crunching, the statistics, to show which group of people were did the most strike breaking. But I think the ones for that it was exaggerated for African Americans. And we can attribute that to, well, maybe a number of factors. African Americans stood out from the rest of white workers. You can tell who's an African American, who's not an African American by looking at people. How can you tell a Polish American from an Italian American, from an Irish American, yada, 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 who were breaking strikes? Hard to tell. So simple things like that. And, of course, the racism at the time period really put African Americans down on the socioeconomic, cultural, political, biological evolutionary ladder, in all accounts, by the end of the last two or three decades of the 19th century and into the first two or three decades of the 20th century. So, as far as African American women are concerned, like women generally, their prospects of employment were more were limited, severely limited. With African American women, especially in the South, if they weren't in the fields or coerced back into the fields as sharecroppers,
which happened increasingly after the in the latter years of the Reconstruction and after Reconstruction. If they weren't sharecroppers, then they were either domestic servants working mainly in white people's homes, usually the local elites or very affluent middle class or very affluent white working class people's homes, or they were engaged in occupations like being laundresses, well, being self-employed laundry workers, let's put it that way. I have a hard time pronouncing that word, too. and also, let's see, yeah, working as and doing laundry or domestics as, or being domestic servants. In the North, it's pretty much, again, domestic servants and laundry, self-employed laundry workers doing other people's, other families' laundry. Well, increasingly, we see African-American women, and they do enter industrial occupations. It was glassmaking in particular, glassmaking factories. In most cases, they weren't doing the skilled work in those factories. They were doing unskilled tasks, unskilled jobs within those factories and such. But they were entering into industrial occupations in small numbers, but it was steady. Now, the other labor federation that became important as far as offering a counter-narrative, that is, whereas the American Federation of Labor, officially on the national level, or national headquarters, had no, let's say, did not have a platform against black workers. Many of its member unions, unions that affiliated with the American Federation of Labor, had in their constitution and bylaws that black workers can't join or they must be in segregated locals, except for maybe where African Americans were well represented in the United Mine Workers or Teamsters. But after the collapse of the Knights of Labor, which basically collapsed by 1888, 1889, although there were still active chapters, but they were a shadow of themselves throughout the 1890s. It was the industrial workers of the world that burst upon the scene when several very militant unions, some of them are unions based in the western states, miners' unions, for example, who came together in Chicago in 1905 to form the industrial workers of the world. Whereas the Knights of Labor envisioned cooperative society, and whereas the American Federation of Labor made peace with industrial capitalism, or at least tried to make peace with industrial capitalism, the industrial workers of the world were basically anti-capitalist, anti-industrial capitalism to the hilt. They made no bones about it. They were quite open about it. They want to abolish the wage system. Basically, and they talked about a revolution, the one big union. The revolution will come when workers come together as one big union. So they saw themselves building that one big union and bringing in a socialist society, a socialism of some type. I guess their counterpart in Europe will be anarcho-syndicalists, for those who are into that, anarcho-syndicalism. So the industrial workers of the world was the American version of it. And the industrial workers of the world believed in interracial unity among workers. They practiced interracial unity among workers, even in the segregated, rabidly white supremacist South at that time. Now, the industrial workers of the world really made more of an impact upon certain types of workers. I guess workers that were outside or on the periphery of mainstream and industrialization. For example, timber workers, whether in the South or the Pacific Northwest, or workers on the docks, whether it be in New York City, Philadelphia, or San Francisco, elsewhere. Those type of workers, rarely did the industrial workers of the world made inroads into steelmaking or the electrical industry that was in its infancy at that time, or the petroleum industry that was in its infancy at that time, or in the railroad industry, which was, of course, ubiquitous at that time. But nonetheless, black workers were welcome in the industrial workers of the world. But again, it depends where the industrial workers of the world were located. Now, with the industrial workers of the world, given their particular view, their particular politics, they, you can guess they were not well liked by the leadership of the American Federation of Labor. And the American Federation of Labor made no bones about their hatred of the IWW. Obviously, employers would rather deal with the AFL than with the IWW. And when World War One commenced, Uncle Sam saw it to his advantage to form a partnership or vice versa, form a partnership with the American Federation of Labor or vice versa, American Federation of Labor with Uncle Sam, to basically suppress, disrupt, otherwise dismantle, drive underground, or whatever. In other words, to make the IWW ineffective, irrelevant, as far as the working class is concerned. So, but what I want to sketch out is that even though the history of American labor during the heyday of industrialization from the 1870s into the 19-teens, leaned more toward being anti-black. There were moments, you know, a few decades here, several years over there, where there was good sections of the working class that was anti-racist, or at least believed in interracial unity. Although we don't hear much about that. Now, as far as black labor is concerned, the breakthrough, as we all know, was with World War One. World War One was a major watershed in world history, American history, African American history. With World War One, as far as labor was concerned, first of all, the immigrant wave of immigrants from Europe was basically cut off. War. I mean, obviously, the European nations did not want immigration to the United States because most immigrants were military age, able-bodied men were in that immigration stream. So they got to keep their men in the wars in Europe. As far as the United States was concerned, employers found that here was a chance to make big bucks, profit on producing commodities and munitions, so forth, to sell to Great Britain and France, America's chief war allies, before America entered the war, as well as after America entered World War One in 1917. So, although the border cities like East St. Louis, Pittsburgh, and Louisville and Cincinnati saw an increase in the industrial black workers, mostly men, entering industrial occupations, mass production occupations, their numbers dramatically increase with the war, with World War One. The doors were blown wide open for African Americans. Many employers, especially like meatpacking firms, steel manufacturers, sent recruiters south to encourage black workers as if they need any encouragement. All they needed to know was jobs were waiting for them. But to send labor recruiters into the south to tell them, come north, some of them the recruiters industrialists paid the transportation for African Americans to go north. Others did it on their own steam. Whole communities in some places or neighborhoods participated in the migration. And of course that brought forth many, many things. In terms of labor, it helped strengthen the stance of labor, black labor in the South. Namely, if some of the workers have left, that means there will be still more work, but fewer workers. Fewer workers, could they try to increase their wages? Especially if they were sharecroppers, agricultural laborers. And as they moved north, many of these laborers, of course, the pay differential was very attractive, whereas in the South, they would be lucky to make 50 cents a day or even a dollar a day. In the North, $2 a day or more than $2 a day even. Big bucks for these folks back then. So up north they moved into many northern and midwestern industrial cities. Chicago was a prime destination point, but so was Detroit, Buffalo, Cleveland, the industrial cities, other industrial cities in Ohio, Michigan, Gary, Indiana, other industrial cities in Illinois, and of course, East St. Louis was a destination, and St. Louis was a destination, Kansas City. Some went as far as Milwaukee, Wisconsin, or Minneapolis, St. Paul, Minnesota. Wherever the trains could take them, basically. And so African-American workers got a foothold in industry and in the urban industrial economy, big time. And that's going to change the dynamics for African-American laborers for the rest of the 20th century with this great migration. Now, the great migration usually is considered to start in the second year of World War I, 1915, and it will continue until the Great Depression began in 1929, 1930. Then there was a drop-off in the numbers migrating from the South to the North and Midwest. Oh, I must say, also, many white workers were leaving the South at the same time, white working people, heading to the industrial cities of the North and Midwest. So both groups were bringing their culture with them, their expectations, their outlook on life, and their idea of race relations. So, and that's going to mix in with what black northerners, black native northerners, and white native northerners have viewed race relations and industry and so forth, and the role of black workers in the economy. But by World War One, it is obvious that black workers are truly part of the American economy, both industrial and agricultural sectors of the economy. And they were there to stay in the industrial economy. And they were still a significant labor force as far as the agricultural sector of the economy in the southern states, the ex-Confederacy, although, interestingly, increasing numbers of white Southerners were becoming sharecroppers or tenant farmers. But just like rapid industrialization spelled the end of an agricultural America, agricultural America was in a historical dead end, so to speak. Let's say, and the census of 1920 showed that slightly more Americans were involved in an urban industrial economy than in a rural agricultural economy. So, and the trend was that more and more people were losing their land, losing their farms. That was the trend anyway in the latter third of the 19th century, and it would just continue on and on and on in the 20th century. The only reason why Americans were able to feed themselves with fewer farmers, as you know, is because of the industrialization, mechanization of American agriculture, and better scientific techniques of agriculture, so on and so forth. So make American agriculture the envy of the world. But then the American industry was becoming the envy of the world in many different ways as well. Now, let me drop back and talk about, okay, there were what we call race riots, commonly called race riots, although in some cases I would call some of those race riots pogroms or ethnic cleansing. But we can trace these race riots in urban America back to the 1820s in the United States. But they came with more rapidity and or more widespread in the latter third or the latter quarter of the 19th century into the first three decades of the 20th century. Now, we can attribute that to many different reasons. Some will say social strain. A number of black workers moved to the cities. Their population or their percentage of the population jumped from 1, 2, 5% to 20, 30% of the population. That was a strain, according to some people. Very persuasive arguments, although I really don't agree with that. I mean, because the strain was there even when there was an absence of riots or pogroms or massacres, whatever you want to call them. But nonetheless, many of the off-cited reasons for these riots, especially in the 1890s, 1900s, 1910s, into the early 1920s, was because of interracial competition for jobs, housing, so on and so forth. Now, I don't deny that competition or the fear of competition or white worker sense of entitlements for jobs existed. I don't deny that. I just feel that it should be put in its proper perspective, namely that at least in East St. Louis, the local elites or the local ruling class, whatever you want to call it. In my book, I usually say the real estate politician businessmen, because they're the ones that were running the show in East St. Louis. They had their other ideas and so on and so forth. And they had their vision of what they want to turn the city into. Now, in East St. Louis, there were two riots in East St. Louis in 1917. One in May 28 of 1917, and the other one, the famous one, the horrific one, the one that really shook public awareness, public consciousness, that occurred on July 2nd, 1917. Essentially, the riot was a little more than, the two riots were a little more than a month apart. So it's very interesting to compare the actors in both situations and so forth. The first riot, or I call pogrom, was benign. No one was killed. According to the newspapers, around 6,000 or more black residents fled from East St. Louis to St. Louis or surrounding towns. How many returned? I don't know. I don't have the evidence for that. But maybe a number did return. But, of course, people cited the riot was because there were black strike breakers at the Aluminum Ore Company, which was a subsidiary of what is now Alcoa, Aluminum Company of America. But the Aluminum Ore Company, which was the only aluminum ore processing plant in all of North America, which once the United States entered World War I, that factory became strategic as far as the government was concerned. Aluminum for airplanes, aluminum for even things like water canteens for soldiers, you know, on and on and on and on. Well, what I showed was that the Aluminum Ore Company was hiring black workers for unskilled positions at that complex before there was a strike, the second strike at Aluminum Ore, which broke out in mid-April of 1917. It was a bitter strike. A number of black workers joined the strike. And The strike lasted until sometime in May. So, and it ended not on the terms that workers wanted, the aluminum oil company workers wanted. But when I looked at the transcripts of court cases where some aluminum oil company workers threw stones and whatever else at the aluminum oil company president when he was arriving to the plant in his car, chauffeured car, and at the superintendent of the aluminum oil company, during the court cases, none of them mentioned. They mentioned all sorts of grievances, but not one mentioned black workers as strike breakers or that there were black workers, too many black workers in town or whatever. Those type of charges came from other sources. Other sources that have nothing to do with a strike. But it's now part of, but the idea of black strike breakers was part of, has become part of the narrative of East St. Louis. And who knows if that narrative will ever be dethroned. But it makes a good narrative for some people. to talk about white workers' racism and so on and so forth. The thing was that the labor and central, the Central Trades and Labor Union organization, which is like the local coordinator of the AFL unions in East St. Louis, was not, I mean, it was anti-black in the sense that, oh, too many black workers are coming here. The employers will use them to break strikes. But at the same time, we want black workers to be on our side, to be in the unions, et cetera. We're willing to work with black workers to try to get them to be more pro-union than they have been, because what they were thinking of was the meat packers, the big meat packers, which were just on the other side of the city line. Between East St. Louis and National City, the big meat packers, Armour, Swift, Thomas Nelson, they were in National City, which was an industrial enclave for the meat packers and only for the meat packers and the meat packing plants, as a way to avoid city taxes and so forth. But they still derive city services from East St. Louis. But anyway, they had a strike, the three plants, in 1916, in the summer of 1916. And the employers brought in black and white strike breakers, more white strike breakers than black strike breakers. But of course, the boogeyman of the black strike breaker excites the imagination more than the boogeyman of the white strike breaker. but there were black strikers, and some black strikers were leading the meatpacking strike, and the Central Trades and Labor Union organization knew that. The leaders knew that. So they weren't, when both pogroms or riots broke out in East St. Louis, they were more than willing to protect black workers that were who were isolated in downtown East St. Louis. In fact, most of the killings and beatings and expulsion of black residents took place outside of the two major enclaves, the two major predominantly black neighborhoods in East St. Louis. In other words, these black folks that were, many of them that were killed or expelled, were living in mixed race neighborhoods, or they were in small groups or isolated as individuals going shopping or going to or from work in downtown East St. Louis. At least 6,000, or some newspapers say 7,000 black residents permanently fled East St. Louis. But those people who wanted to turn East St. Louis into a sundown town, namely no black residents no black people will ever be allowed to live in the town. That did not happen in East St. Louis. The rioters or the program, I don't use that term, programmists, because I can't really pronounce it that well. But the assailants, the white assailants, the white mobs, did not go into either of the two major black enclaves, especially the one on the south side of East St. Louis, because they were armed. They were well armed. Black folks were bringing in weapons, guns from St. Louis and elsewhere. There was a black mortician who used his hearse to smuggle in weapons around the time of the May pogrom and just before the pogrom that broke out in July. So the mobs knew that, the assailants knew that, and basically stayed away. We don't know how many people were killed on both sides. The official number is 49 people. I think 39 blacks and black people and 10 white people were killed in the East St. Louis pogrom. Now, some people say more white people were killed. I know a few black East St. Louisians told me more white people were killed than black people. But the point was that I want to make as far as black labor was concerned. Black labor was not shake. It was not pushed out of East St. Louis. In fact, when the city was under martial law, the big employers like Alumina Oil Company and Armour Meatpacking, Swift Meatpacking, and some of the other major companies wanted the police, wanted the National Guard to protect the black workers, many of whom were commuting from St. Louis. Former residents who commuted who went to St. Louis, who fled to St. Louis, commuted from St. Louis into East St. Louis to give them protection, as well as give those who are living in the north end and in the south end of East St. Louis, give them protection as they commuted by trolley car to work. So they said, we need these workers. They're important to our industrial effort in East St. Louis. So that would be the situation in other cities, even when Chicago had its major race riot. Now, I would consider Chicago a race riot than a pogrom because there was real political intent on the part of sections in East St. Louis among the political elites, not all of them, but among a good portion of them, who wanted to expel black people from East St. Louis. But not so in Chicago. But even in Chicago, where the meatpacking industry was the number one employer of African Americans, followed by the steel mills in the southern part of Chicago, they wanted the black workers to come and to be escorted by police and National Guard in the immediate aftermath of the strike. I mean, of the race riot in Chicago. Okay. Any questions so far? I know I can go on. I just want to know if you have any questions right now before I continue.
It's been very interesting listening.
Okay.
And,
I'll continue.
You know, I'm just riveted.
Okay. But very good. I'll continue.
What I would suggest, though, is that we wrap up this segment, and then we will figure out where we go from there, because I know you haven't finished. So,
oh, my God, I wasn't even looking at my clock.
So you mesmerized yourself. So
yes,
it was,
I certainly did.
It's very, very, very intriguing, especially this last part that you touched on with East St. Louis. And, you know, people now can make a connection between today's Ferguson and the environs of St. Louis, and what happened in St. Louis, in East St. Louis in 1917. This is really interesting stuff.
We should appreciate the
care that you're taking to take us all the way through. So could we just put a little bit of a finish to this section, and we'll figure out how we go forward again to finish off the entire presentation, perhaps in, absolutely in another segment.
Yes.
Okay, well, you just mentioned Ferguson. I just want to say one thing. Just like I associated the real estate interests as the key instigators behind what happened in East St. Louis in 1917, I read a newspaper account that's recently about Ferguson, and it was only in one newspaper account, and I believe it was a local one, that basically said that that burnt-out area of Ferguson is an area that some real estate tycoons want to develop. So who knows? Did they import provocateurs to Ferguson to do arson? It's very interesting. The police kind of stood down while some people were busy torching businesses and other buildings. Just like in the second pogrom in East St. Louis of July 1917, the police basically looked the other way while people went around torching not only black people's homes and black people's businesses, but also some businesses that employed African Americans. So, and the area that was really destroyed by the pogrom in East St. Louis was an area that the real estate interests in East St. Louis wanted to develop. So who knows? Who knows? Someone has to do some digging and research. But
so okay. Tell us what we will do in the next segment, because we didn't get to touch on the progressive era that much. You came to it, but we can continue this in the next segment.
Okay, will do. But I guess I'll leave people with the idea that World War I was a major watershed for African American labor, and for African American labor to enter into the urban industrial economy in significant numbers, and that those significant numbers influenced the labor movement. First, the American Federation of Labor, and definitely when we get to talking about the Congress of Industrial Organizations, the CIO, in the late 1930s, where the CIO definitely took an anti-racism stance, at least officially, saying that we have to organize black workers. We have to. Labor will not. Organized labor will be in very difficult moments if organized labor doesn't organize black workers, because even though African Americans have a unwarranted reputation of being a race of strike breakers, when you look into some of the strikes they broke strikes where employers and or the local labor union refuse black workers admittance into the occupation, into that factory, into working at that factory, whatever.
Well, I want to thank you so much, Professor Lumpkin, for being with us today. This was, I was just riveted by the story and the continuum of struggle all the way through. And certainly, as you bring to light the efforts and the various ways in which African Americans basically tried to take hold of the value of their labor and to direct their energy toward that end, fulfilling all the other things that normal people would fulfill anyway, which is to take care of their families and to establish stable communities and so forth. This is very, very important because we need to – this is a juxtaposition to this widespread unemployment, and we see it in the historical perspective that you give. We see how the system devises all these different structures and these means to impede or to completely deny the right to work among African Americans.
Definitely, the right to work, also the right to work with dignity.
Absolutely. I want to thank you so much for being with us. We'll discuss when we get off the air what would be a good time or day for you to complete the presentation, but it's been extraordinarily informative, and I want to thank you so much for being so generous with your time on Lead
Stories.
Well, I
thank you for your patience and putting up with me.
Oh, no, this is great. This is great. This is a college course. I hope people understand that. This is a college course that you're giving us here and opening our eyes to a subject matter that is very seldom discussed.
Yes, so, yes. I'm very happy that I'm bringing this up. Yeah, people forget that much of African-American history is about working people.
So we'll talk again, and I'll be able to inform the listeners as to when your next installment will be. But I hope it will be very, very soon. Thank you so much for being with us today.
Thank you.
And thank you for listening. Again, this is extraordinary information. This is college-level work, if you will. It's a free course in the history of black labor. We're taking a look at Civil War to the Civil Rights Movement. And our guide we are lucky to have is Professor Charles Lumpkins, author of American Pogrom, the East St. Louis Race Riot and Black Politics. Keep it right here. Infectious Myth with David Crow is up next. And you can reach me at leadstories@gmail.com or on Facebook, Lead Stories with Utrece Lead. Thank you so much for being with me today. A pleasure and a great privilege to be in your company.